purchase our comfortable and natural-appearing dentures within 90 days, and we'll pay for your oral exam and digital x-rays. Please don't hesitate to learn more or to arrange a free initial consultation. Call 476-8700. That's 476-8700. Or visit myvtsmiles.com. All smiles on the Barrymont Pelier Road. Are you all smiles?
All smiles, all smiles. All smiles, all smiles.
It's time to get the story behind the story. Interviews with newsmakers, newsbreakers, and your phone calls. Radio Vermont presents The Mark Johnson Show.
Thank you, Jim Condon. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program. Thanks for tuning in. A little slippery out there on the highways this morning. Not a big deal, but make sure you just leave yourself a little bit of extra time. And God, I mean, give people a little bit of room out there on the road, would you? Coming up on the program this morning, in our second hour, we're going to chat with Mark Shapiro. He actually joined us back on the program in November, talking about his book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. Wow, there's a subhead that could have maybe used an editor. He's going to be testifying before the Vermont legislature coming up next week. We will chat with him later this morning. You don't need to mention that I said anything about his subtitle here. All right, and we're going to take your phone calls throughout the program. Let me give you the numbers, 244-1777. That's our local number in central Vermont. And you can also reach us on our toll-free lines at 877-291-8255. That's 244-1777 and toll-free. 877-291-8255. We're going to begin this morning. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to the Auditor of Accounts. Doug Hoffer is joining us here live in our studios. We're going to talk about a wide range of issues, including ski leases, medical procedures, and John Gruber. Thanks for joining us on the program this morning. How are you?
My pleasure. Thanks.
So how was your drive down from Burlington today?
It was a little hairy, not terrible. It wasn't icy, a little sloppy, but as usual, there are some people going too fast, some trucks going too fast, but you just got to be patient.
Yeah.
You know.
A little more. It was much worse in the passing lane than in the travel lane.
Always, yeah.
Are you auditing anything within the snow department in the state of Vermont?
No, as far as I can tell, the guys running those trucks are doing a great job.
Yeah. Let's actually start with John Gruber. He was the consultant, the healthcare consultant for the state of Vermont, also for the Obama administration, got in a lot of hot water making some really critical comments about the American public and their stupidity. He sent some bills to the state of Vermont. He had some $400,000 contract that has been since reduced. But he sent some bills to the state of Vermont that you were not all that happy with. What was the problem?
Well, there were a couple. Some rose to the level of concern, some not so much. But the contract made it clear, as most do for personal services, that when you submit an invoice, there's got to be some kind of a description of the work performed, in addition to some detail about the hours worked and by whom and when and so forth. And in this case, they were very simple invoices. Interestingly, after the administration was requested to provide information about the back and forth between Dr. Gruber and the staffers who worked with him, you found a couple of emails between the principals here in state government saying, is this enough information that he has provided us to okay this and pay it? And ultimately they said yes, which is kind of curious. But it's important for people to understand that in this particular situation, as I understand it, and having been a contractor, you know, a policy analyst on my own for almost 20 years, I have some knowledge of this. This guy and however many were working with him were literally in daily touch with the two key people in the administration. It's not as if he was off in the corner working for weeks at a time and they had no knowledge of what he was doing. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any question that they knew at the time fully exactly what he had been doing, literally hour by hour. So I'm not too concerned about that, although the contract called for, so he should have done it. But there are two parties to a contract. He didn't do it, but they didn't make him do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a problem on both sides. The more interesting things to me were related to the dollars and the hours. And here again, I can understand how it happened, but that doesn't excuse it. Both invoices, at that time, I think a subsequent invoice has been submitted, which I haven't seen, but they were for about 6-week periods, and each one indicated a number of hours that was identical. 100 hours for Dr. Gruber, and I think 500 for one or more research assistants, programmers, however they're categorized. And that may well have been the truth, but it might have been just convenient.
Wow. I mean, that's an incredible coincidence.
Yeah, I guess,
it?
Yeah. And here again, if the state didn't object and say, after the first one, these are kind of round numbers, Dr. Gruber, could you give us a little more detail? And by the way, who are these people, and did they submit this stuff to you? They didn't do that. Mm-hmm. So I have requested that information. I initially asked the administration to get it from him, and that's typically what we do with a third party. We go to the contractor, whether it's a State Department, in this case, the Central Administration. And some time went by, and I think the reason for the original delay is that he was still working. And they desperately wanted to get him to finish this stuff before their self-imposed deadline, whatever that was. And once he did, still some time went by, which was disappointing. So I informed them that having received nothing from him, mm-hmm. I would then go directly to him, which I did. He got back to me pretty quickly and said, I have your request. I'll be happy to talk with you. I'm going out of the country for a bit. I'll be back, and then we'll talk again. About a week went by. I sent him a follow-up, and then I got a communication from a representative of his here in Vermont, and we'll see what happens in the next few days.
Okay.
Basically, I'm looking for documentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he billed the state, which paid a portion. I think they withheld, as they were allowed to do by contract, about 20%
right.
in each instance. And we don't know who he distributed those monies to. Did he keep it all? I seriously doubt it, but we don't know. I'd just like to see some documentation, which might include the W-2s if they're employees, the 1099s if they're independent, and so forth. So that's what I've requested, and we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So is this typical? I mean, is this kind of lack of documentation typical?
Maybe not to this extent. This is kind of an unusual circumstance, but my office, just in my short tenure, has done some work looking into contracts, much larger contracts, of course, multi-millions. And there has been a pattern. It's not that they're not monitoring the contracts at all, because, as I said, in this case, they knew the product they were getting.
Right.
This one, to me, is just about the billing procedures.
Right.
But we have found some instances where there's some uncertainty or a lack of sufficient data to determine with certainty that the services that we're paying for were provided to third parties, typically Vermonters. And, is it a scandal? No, of course not. Could they do better? Yes. Is some of it just a matter of priorities and resources? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of consistent, and it may be common to all large organizations. I don't know. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the administration, I think, I hope, takes it seriously when we provide them with the reports and the findings and recommendations. So that's all we can do.
Yeah. Okay. So it sounds like what you're saying here is that he clearly did the work, but just didn't do the documentation terribly well here.
So he didn't provide any documentation to the state, and he hasn't yet provided it to me. It's possible that there was little, if any, contemporaneous documentation. And, you know, that's not good enough. For example, my office contracts with a big firm, KPMG, to do the single audit, the so-called federal single audit, and the CAFR, the audit of the state's financial statements. And we have a fairly complicated contract with them, but part of the contract is a clear description and delineation of the people who will be working on each project, how much they're paid per hour,
mm-hmm.
and then when they invoice, they give us the detail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they say these individuals at this level will be paid $165 an hour, we don't know whether they're actually paid $165. KPMG has overhead and profit and all this stuff, and I don't need to know that
yeah.
level of detail. I
right.
just need to know how many hours Fred worked and, you know, Bill and John, so forth, and they give us that.
Okay.
And that's the least you can expect from a contract.
There's an attorney in Charlotte, Brady Tenzing, who there's a news site called Breitbart News. He's raising this question about whether or not there was padding of the bills.
I have no idea. How would I know?
I mean, and I'm wondering how he would even raise that suggestion without knowing.
You'd have to ask him. I think he's a fellow with an agenda, as far as I can tell.
Okay. So you're waiting for them to give you documentation, and then, so has he been paid, or is he not going to be paid until that happens?
I believe there is an outstanding invoice for work done after the contract was amended. And I've asked the administration to hold off on that until we resolve this stuff.
Okay. I remember at one point you were looking at healthcare in terms of whether or not the recommendations that have been made on the Vermont Health Connect, the website that's been having so many problems, and whether or not that had actually come to pass if the recommendations had been followed through. And you know, at the time you weren't really opening this up to the whole thing of looking at whether or not, you know, this $100 million was adequately and properly spent. Is that, I mean, I don't know, given this problem with Gruber, given the continuing problems with Vermont Health Connect, is there a point at which you might do that?
Sure. We considered a bunch of options before we started the one that we're engaged in now, which is very complicated and has 3 of my 10 auditors working all the time, full time on this one job. But that's more about what Wow. we're learning from what has happened before and is still ongoing so that we can do better going forward. There's no question in anybody's mind that there were problems in the original contracts. I think, you know, your colleagues and you and others have covered this adequately. Is it important that at some point we drill down? Yes. But we decided in the office, after talking it over with the senior staff and my deputy, that this might make more sense for now. You alluded to what we're doing. All throughout this process, there have been third parties, independent third parties, at least they knew enough to hire these folks, mm-hmm. Who have been watching this process, different aspects of it all along, and in each instance issued a report with, in some cases, dozens of recommendations in half a dozen different categories that are critical and pretty much outline why we're where we are.
Mm-hmm.
So the question for us is, okay, they have these recommendations, they've had them for a period of time. Have they followed up? Have they...
Right.
put the resources in place in the right place at the right time to move forward and correct the problem? And if not, then we have a much bigger problem. They can't even respond to the recommendations from their own outside experts. We are going to have a financial aspect to this audit, but it'll be descriptive. We're not auditing contracts at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll get, we can only do so much. We only have so many people.
Wow, I didn't realize that took 3 out of your 10 people. That's a big hit on the staff.
Yeah, well, I think they're enjoying it. They're learning a lot. It's complicated. It should be a great report.
Explain to people.
It might be one of those that actually gets read by more than 27 people. You know?
Wow,
could have a bestseller here.
Wow, all right, you crack 30. Hey, that's a big deal. So why did you look into the Gruber thing? Explain to people how these kinds of things start.
Well, this one obviously was of interest when it first came out. I was anxious to see how the administration responded, and within a week or so, they indicated that they intended to amend the contract, quite apart from how people responded to his comments, but
right.
with regard to the contract and the invoice issues themselves. I can't imagine how much time and how many people participated in collecting the information to respond to all the public records requests. I think it was substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So that held them up for a little bit, and... I have some of those documents. I didn't need all of them, as I alluded to some of them before, the email
right.
traffic. But I was not ready to jump in at that point. I wanted to see what would happen, how the administration would handle it. I then got a couple of requests from legislators and thought, what the heck, why not? You know, out of respect for them, and the process is of interest to people. So, and I'm doing it myself. I don't need to take staff time for this. It's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm. And this was requests that were made by a Democrat, Republican, and a Prague. No, it was not.
No progs. 2 Republicans and a Democrat.
Okay, right. Sorry, I got that wrong. I knew there was a Democrat in there. I thought there was a progressive, too. All right. If you have any comments or questions this morning for the Auditor of Accounts, you can join us at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. Toll-free 877-291-8255. I couldn't help but notice that you said that John Gruber said that he was heading out of the country. I wonder if there was a place on planet Earth he could get away. Far enough from the coverage. My goodness.
No.
So did he give you any sort of sense of his reaction to this whole controversy that was going on when you talked to him, or are you just talking numbers?
It's interesting that the thing that was of interest to him, of concern to him, I should say, in the context of the questions I posed, was that he was hoping or preferred to protect the identity of one or more of his research assistants who, he said, you know, after what I've been through, I don't want them to have to go through it to pay a price for what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And as it happened, the administration, in providing some documents in response to the public records request, did redact the names. Now, I wasn't a party to that. They presumably got advice from the Attorney General's office or from their own attorneys in the administration. So I'm going to honor that for the time being.
We'll take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about ski leases. We'll also talk about the wisdom or lack thereof of printing the amounts of and the costs of medical procedures. We'll continue our discussion with the auditor, 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. We'll be back right after this.
Capital Ground.
Did you remember the coffee?
Capital Ground.
You didn't?
Ugh.
Let this happen to you. There wouldn't be anything better than getting coffee in the mail. Our coffee is so special that we've rolled out a new subscription program. Each month, new package arrives, coffees from around the world. You don't even have to think about it. And it's great for that person or friend or relative living out of town. We've heard from people around the world that tell us that Capital Grounds coffee is the best thing they've ever had, so we wanted to make it convenient. You can check it out at capitalgrounds.com. Coffee, we know it, we love it. Since 1998, Capital Grounds Roasters has delivered the best coffee to Central Vermont. Available at Capital Grounds Cafe on State Street in Montpelier.
Capital Grounds.
Check out our new subscription program, capitalgrounds.com.
Capital Grounds.
Hi, this is Rich Harvey from Montpelier Pharmacy and Waterbury Pharmacy. It's a new year full of hope and promise. Many people are determined to shed some of those extra pounds that they've put on over the last few years, and that's a great idea. Here's a few suggestions. Remember, it took you a long time to put on those pounds. Don't expect to lose them all in a month. The key to losing weight is to adjust what you eat. Smaller portions is a good start. Trick yourself by using a smaller plate so that your plate still looks full. Trust me, it works. Reduce snacking. Replace that potato on your plate with another vegetable. Cut down on breads. Drink more water. Exercise more. The key to losing weight is creating a healthy eating plan that you can stick with because you still enjoy what you're eating. Once you've done that, the pounds will come off slowly, but continue to come off, and by this time next year, you'll be slimmer and healthier. So have a happy and healthy new year. If you have questions about your prescriptions, give us a call at Montpelier Pharmacy or Waterbury Pharmacy. Locally owned and independent. Thank you.
Here's another Vermont Lottery Extreme Fun Alert. The Powerball jackpot is getting very large. You may want to go immediately to your nearest Vermont Lottery agent to purchase a Powerball ticket.
Knee-deep. Knee-deep. Knee-deep.
Hey, what's with the frog? He just showed up one day.
Yeah, I thought frog said ribbit.
Knee-deep.
This one says knee-deep.
Frogger is here from the Vermont Lottery. Based on the classic Frogger game, you can win up to $5,000 instantly. Play the instant ticket. Play online. You can even play on your smartphone. Buy Frogger today and be
knee-deep
in fun from the Vermont Lottery. Courtesy of Konami Digital Entertainment. Please play responsibly.
Knee-deep.
This is an extreme fun alert reminder. The Powerball jackpot is getting very large. Buy your ticket today.
All profits benefit the Vermont Education Fund. Please play responsibly.
Today's estimated annuitized jackpot is $317 million.
We're back continuing our discussion this morning. Doug Hoffer is the Auditor of Accounts. If you would like to join us on the program, you can at 244-1777. That's our local number in Central Vermont. Toll free 877-291-8255. Are you a downhill skier?
No.
Okay.
Although I did many, many years ago when I lived in the Berkshires, and it was a lot of fun, but I'm a golfer, as you know. I don't want to break things.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. I want to talk about the ski leases that are involved with the upper reaches, some of the upper mountains here in Vermont, and maybe you can give us a little bit of the history here. This goes way back where the state provided some key early developers a pretty good deal.
Oh, they did, indeed. I think the first was 1942, there was a second in 46, and then some in the 50s. And it was a perfectly reasonable idea at the time. There was this new thing called, you know, alpine downhill skiing, and there were people doing it. They didn't have infrastructure. They just had to, you know, trudge up the hill and come down. And a fellow in-state government, I think the commissioner at that point of Forest Parks and Recreation, said, you know, we have some land up top. Maybe we can work together on this. And it made perfect sense. They wanted to help grow an industry, and they did, and they succeeded. Over time, the leases were changed mostly in the 60s and early 70s, and the terms were set. They're not entirely consistent across the leases, but the outline is pretty much the same. The state would get a percentage of lift ticket revenues from lift lines that cross state land, and a little tiny piece from retail and food and beverage, if it was on state land. So, you know, things are rocking along for decades, and during that period, some of the ski areas came in and said, well, you started out with 3 or 4 10-year terms, which was perfectly appropriate because they needed security to make these large capital investments. But, hey, why don't you give us 3 or 4 or 5 more 10-year terms? And the state at every instance said, well, sure. But at those moments is when they had some leverage, and they never used it. And there's a reason why they could have tried, because there are some terms in the leases that are curious at best. For example, in Killington and at Smuggler's Notch, the lease says that improvements on state land, ski lifts, snowmaking equipment, structures, are the property of the state. Now, that doesn't mean that the ski resorts don't maintain them and replace them as needed and so forth, but mm-hmm. technically they belong to the state. The upshot of that is that those towns can't tax that property. ski lifts and so forth. So they lose out. Secondarily, the state, which, as you know, pays a payment in lieu of taxes to towns for both land and buildings that the state owns, which are not taxable otherwise, they then have to pay the towns, the host towns, a payment in lieu of taxes for that equipment, even though the towns can't tax it. It's bizarre. Hmm. And it gives those two areas an advantage over their sister areas. But the more important thing is that the ability to determine or to decide whether to renew a lease is entirely up to the ski resort. And the state, for its part, has no power to open these leases for any reason. There are a couple of modest provisions about breach, and that's typically related to whether the resort puts in enough money to run the place from, you know, whatever it is, October to April.
Okay.
Other than that, it's rock solid. Now, as I said, we all know, and we were the first to say in the report, this has produced significant revenues for the state.
Yeah.
Rooms and meals tax, alcohol, sales tax, and so forth, and property tax. We'll get to that in a minute. But those dollars are paid by the people from Vermont and out of state who come and buy those goods and services, not by the ski areas themselves. The ski lease payments, compared to those payments, which have grown tremendously over the last 15, 20 years in particular, adjusted for inflation, the ski lease payments have declined during that period. Because I think as they've grown, they get revenue from all these other sources, these other amenities, which people clearly like, golf courses, indoor facilities, performing arts centers, and particularly real estate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a big deal.
Yeah.
And again, that's their business plan, more power to them. They're investing the money, they should get a return. But we're only getting a return on one revenue source, which was all there was back in the day. Now there are others. So the simple central question was, are the people of the state getting a fair return for the lease of these very valuable public assets?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me see if I have this right. Are you even extending something like lift tickets to today the value you would extend even to the condominiums? I mean, I understand the condominiums wouldn't have the value that they had if they weren't on the hill. But are you trying to tap into that stream the way that the state has tapped into the lift ticket stream?
Well, I'm not trying to do anything. I have no power to do any of that. All we can do is provide information to policymakers and to the general public. But the point is to get policymakers to ask the question. Now, unfortunately, those leases themselves are locked up until 2052. There's one of them comes up in the 2030s, but the rest are into the 2050s, unless the ski areas agree to come in and have a conversation.
So let me just see, I don't mean to interrupt you, but let me make sure I understand this right. So these are contracts that are at the option of the ski area to renew?
Every 10 years.
So it's up to them. It's like it sounds like a magazine subscription.
Indeed, unless they come in and ask for something, which, as I say, they've done a number of times in turn, asking for extensions. There have been some land swaps.
All right.
A number of times over the years, there have been opportunities where the state had some leverage. And as far as we can tell, they never attempted to use or utilize that leverage.
Okay.
Back to the real estate.
Yeah.
These are, I mean, I don't know what they are, but they're beautiful condos and lodges, and people pay good money to stay at them, buy them, buy timeshares or outright or whatever. And they, you know, the ski areas deserve a return on that investment, as with all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the value, I would say a considerable portion of the value to those types of facilities, is because of their immediate proximity to the spectacular high elevation land that is the property of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how would we get to that? I don't know. I mean, there are ways to structure that. You could ask for them to pay a percentage of total revenues, right? However that's defined and calculated.
Okay. Yep.
But the point is, that's up to the legislature. We wanted them to know that this issue has not been discussed in many, many years. There was a report 6 or 7 years ago that looked at a number of issues, but not this one. It did not look directly at whether the lease fee payments are providing a fair return to the people of the
mm-hmm.
state.
When you say that there's a percentage that the state gets of things like lift tickets, so
5%.
So
only of lift tickets on lift lines that cross state land, which obviously in the beginning provided an incentive for them to put lifts off state land, if at all possible.
Okay. All right. So how does that work? Because you pay a flat amount for a lift ticket, right?
Oh, as we know, and as they reminded us afterwards, there's lots of ways to pay. One of them is just a day ticket. Another is a seasonal ticket. There's packages, all kinds of stuff.
Okay. I'm not asking the question correctly.
Oh, how do they calculate it?
No, I mean, if you're saying, I'm confused here, because you're saying that this only applies to lifts that are on,
right. They take
across
the
state property.
Right. They take the total revenue from lift tickets.
Okay.
However, they calculate that, because some of them are packages that have other things on
them.
$100 from lift tickets. Then they find out that 60% of the linear feet of all lifts are on state land.
Okay.
Right? Then they multiply that times $100, then they take 5% of that.
I see. That's okay, it. So it'd be based on 5% of $60.
Right.
Okay,
right.
All right. Wow, all right. That is, so I guess my question was, so has that number gone up dramatically over the years so that if I were in their position, I'd say, you don't mess with the leases here. You're making so much more money than you used to make in the old days on lifts.
Well, of course, I don't have access to their financials. All we know is what they report to the state annually for the in the context of the lease payments.
Has the amount of money in this 5% grown each year and substantially over time?
Well, as I said, in the last 20 years, it's declined when adjusted for inflation.
Now, the lease, you said, did, but I'm talking about this 5% that the state
gets. The percent
gets.
Has remained the same.
I know the percent has stayed the same, but has the number of lift tickets sold increased?
We don't have the number of tickets sold. We only have total revenue.
Okay. So the money, I'm sorry if this is...
That's quite all right.
The money that's coming into the state of Vermont based on this 5% fee on the lift tickets, has that gross amount gone up over the years?
Yes.
Substantially?
Slightly. I wouldn't say substantially. No, the real growth has been in the other stuff, retail, rooms, meals, alcohol.
Okay.
And real estate-related stuff.
Okay.
Property values.
Got it. Let's take a couple of calls here. Let me have you put those headphones on. 244-1777 is our local number. Toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's go to Essex. Bruce, good morning.
Good morning to you both. Doug, thank you for that study on the ski area leases, doing environmental history. I find it extremely useful, and I really appreciated how your staff put on graphics to show the extent of state land that the ski areas operate on.
Yeah, that was fun. Thank you.
And the thing to keep in mind for listeners and Mark, Harry Merrill, the former state forester and commissioner of forest parks, was behind all of this stuff. He, Dean Davis said he acted like a czar. He outlasted 19 governors, particularly at a period of time when the commissioners weren't appointed by the governor. They weren't answerable to the governor. They had their own power bases. And Merrill really promoted the ski industry, and there were concerns that he was overdoing it. Even FDR expressed concern in 36. He came up to Vermont to dedicate the Waterbury Dam,
wow,
hold a conference on flood control, and he says, I'm concerned that Vermont's doing too much to promote recreation in its highlands rather than preserving them for flood control. So
wow.
It's a detailed history, and your document, Doug, adds to it, and I thank you for it.
Thank you.
That
appreciate
is interesting. That's an interesting history. 244-1777, that's our local number in central Vermont. You can also reach us toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Williamstown. Good morning, Rama.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Hey, first off, I mean, even to expand on the thanks that gentleman just previously gave you, Doug, I think you do a really great job as an auditor, and I thank you for the topics you look into and the thoroughness that you put into it.
Well, thank you for the kind words.
One of my pet peeves in the modern-day political discussion having to do with schools and consolidation and finances and all, it keeps coming up about all the school board members in the state of Vermont as if somehow we're responsible for this huge amount of spending that's going on in the state. Now, I don't know. Have you ever thought about, or would it be feasible for you to actually audit the school governance system with an eye towards seeing if it's the number of school boards that are driving, or let me get even more neutral. What effect does the number of school board members have on the outcomes and the expenses involved?
Well, that's a two-part question. The first is, have we considered and discussed the opportunities and the possibilities of auditing in the education arena? And the answer is yes. It's not dissimilar to healthcare. It's so big, with so many moving parts, that it's challenging to figure out what works for us in terms of defining a set of objectives that are reasonable and will help the discourse going forward. So we're not there yet, but we're working on it. As to the second question, that's a tough one. I don't know whether that's an objective that lends itself to an audit. That's a policy question, which is a very important one. I don't know if it's best suited to my shop or others, but it is in the mix.
All right. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Back on the ski thing. Well, so why did you open that up? Why did you open up discussion on that?
Well, I had been thinking about it for years, personally, before I became state auditor. And when I hired Andrew Stein to do some non-audit inquiries, as they're called. I'm not happy with the title, but that's what we have at the moment. It seemed something that he was well-suited to. He does great research, and he dug in, and it was a little bit more complex than we anticipated going in, particularly when we decided to try to get the tax information, and including the grand list and property tax stuff, because that you had to go to the towns, and it's a mess. But he did a good job. He stuck with it. And as to that earlier gentleman's comment about the visuals, I originally asked him if we could do some 3D stuff mm-hmm. because of the subject matter. And he said, we can do better than that. We can do video. And he put some time in, and it's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think the office has ever done anything quite like that. But, you know, it's a big deal. These are public assets. You know, it doesn't rise to the level of grazing fees out in the West for buffalo or, you know, cows or whatever. But I thought it was something that was worthy of consideration. I was aware of this report that had been done 6 or 7 years ago that specifically excluded looking at this topic, and I thought, what the heck?
Mm-hmm. Do you have any numbers off the top of your head that would be sort of helpful in giving us an idea of what kind of money we're talking about here? I mean, what is Killington pay for a lease, for example?
The total lease revenues from the 7 resorts that lease state land is $2.9 million in the most recent year.
Okay.
Killington is the largest.
Okay.
No question.
As should be, right. Yeah. But we're talking really like, you know, $400,000 bucks a piece.
No, it varies tremendously.
On average.
Based on a number of things. One, how many acres they lease. Second, the linear footage on state land. And also how much they've developed their parcels. And some of them are relatively modest payments, and Killington's is big, although Killington's has been declining in actual dollars, not just in inflation-adjusted, which is curious.
How's that happen?
Not surprisingly, Jay has grown dramatically as a percentage, and also in terms of dollars. They're making a lot of investments and expanding rapidly. Stowe has increased quite a bit, although not so much in lift tickets, but in their whole operation because of the Spruce Peak stuff.
Okay.
So the report, I don't have it in front of me, but the report does have a pie chart that'll show you the contribution from the 7 different areas.
Why would Killington's have gone down?
That question was posed in the report by EPR back in 2006 or 7, and one of the recommendations in the report was that the state should follow up and do an audit, which they're allowed to do by terms of the lease, which has never been done in any of the resorts. And they haven't done that for any number of reasons, but I think they're thinking about it now. The Killington was sold, as you know,
right,
a few years back, and I think the owners, when they came in, presumably were thinking, hey, we can turn this around, and I'm not sure that they have yet, but they have a lot of plans. I think they have some plans that are in the permitting process
mm-hmm.
for some more development.
Are you going to make, I know Senator Tim Ash is looking at this, are you making a recommendation to the legislature or not?
Knowing that the leases aren't up for another 30, 40 years, all that can be done is as I think Senator Ash may do, is to invite them to come in and have a conversation. There is another option, however. There is, it's technically not a tax exemption, but it's effectively a tax exemption. When shortly after Act 60 and 68, it was decided by the legislature that the education, statewide education tax would not include these improvements on state land
mm-hmm.
at these resorts, not just the ones that leased land from us, but the others. And that represents $80 to $90 million of untaxed property, which would be $2 to $3 million to the state education fund, and they could change that. They could decide to tax that. Since they can't get at the leases, that's an opportunity. But that's
okay.
up to them. I mean,
mm-hmm.
what we can do is provide information to inform the debate.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to make a recommendation to them that they try to tax that other property as a way to maybe get them to come on in and have a discussion?
We let them know that that's an opportunity.
Okay. They have an opportunity for you to come in. All right, let's go to Cabot. Tony, let's take the opportunity. Good morning.
Good morning. I want to add my my thanks for the service of this operation. The having done some applied research way back years ago in a previous lifetime, if we just take a step back from this, there's the collection of information, there's the analysis, then there's the interpretation, and then we get to the so what questions, the implications questions. And so my question for your guest is, at what point Are you there where the rubber meets the road? In other words, do you have to wait for an invitation from the legislature to present the information to help them to make decisions, or is there something in the charter that's built in that permits you to bring this kind of information to the forefront with the intent of changing things?
Right. It's the latter. By statute, I'm authorized to not only do those things that are very fundamental for an auditor's office, the financial audits, which we contract to KPMG for, but since we do performance auditing, ultimately the decision is mine unless the legislature specifically requests something, as they did with the sex offender registry audit. We get to say to ourselves, look, it's a big state government. There's an awful lot of things to audit. You know, what do we want to work on? Who's got the particular interest and skills and experience to inform this job? So we don't have to wait. To answer your question, we are completely independent. The process is wide open. And in this case, of course, nobody asked for this information. I doubt anybody was even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Here's a specific question, if you'll permit me one more. And this I ask out of ignorance, but I've heard both sides of this one. The question is, you know, there's from the lottery, there's the explanation that says, you know, the funds go to the education, towards education, and there are other folks that say, well, it never really does. It goes into the general fund. So can you help me understand how that works?
We haven't audited the lottery, so I can't give you too much on that. I never spent any time on it. I can tell you that we did just produce an audit on the Department of Liquor Control, which is similar in some ways, although their money does go to the general fund. But I can't give you any details about the lottery.
Okay.
I would hope that it goes to the education fund, because that's what they've been telling us for all these years.
Yeah, they have.
Yeah,
thank you,
Tony. Oh, I appreciate it. You know, my limited understanding of how this works is it all comes in and then it's supposedly dedicated, but you know, I mean, it
just
passes through
yeah.
the same
right.
checking account theoretically. Let's talk about medical expenses here. Of late, you've been raising this question about whether consumers would be better off knowing more information, the prices of particular medical procedures. That sounds like it makes sense.
Thank you.
But there are those that challenge this. So tell me, we'll get to that in a moment. What's your theory here?
I'm not sure that anybody challenges it. I think we've heard from some quarters that it's a little more complicated than it might appear.
All right.
And that's certainly the case. But what's happened is over time, as more and more people have higher deductibles, many people, not all, but many, we individually and as families, we are taking more responsibility for a bigger piece
mm-hmm.
of the cost of everything healthcare related. So the ability to shop for non-emergency related stuff, whether it's imaging like an MRI or a knee replacement or a colonoscopy or whatever it might be, at least has the potential, knowing, as we do, that there are considerable price differences around the state and around the country, better informed consumers, ideally and in theory, makes for better decisions. And I think at a time when we're all concerned about the growth in, you know, the rate of growth in healthcare expenditures, this does make perfect sense. And in fact, the legislature for over 20 years has been interested in this subject and went so far about 10 years ago as to say, you know, you insurers, as of next year, you're going to start reporting to us every single transaction that you pay for, every medical service, every medical product, all of it. And that has become this database, this all-payer database called VCures, that includes, thankfully, which makes it really cool, Medicare and Medicaid spending as well. It's virtually everything. It's remarkable.
Okay.
For all the providers in the state, not just hospitals, but non-hospital providers as well.
Wow, that must be really gold mine of info.
It is. And the Green Mountain Care Board, which has responsibility for this, has used it extensively for many purposes, policy research and other things. The one goal that the legislature set that they have not yet used it for is to provide transparency to consumers. And as it happens over time, a couple of other states have already done this in different ways. New Hampshire has its own website. Massachusetts now has required insurers to do it on their own websites because the data is there. So this report, I think, as with the ski area stuff, simply raised the issue to another level and said, you know, why aren't we doing this?
Mm-hmm. So your argument, though, is that if you're a consumer and you know the cost of a medical procedure, that you might try to save money by getting the less expensive one the way I might with a car?
This is where it gets complicated.
Okay.
I mean, and the legislature understood that for consumers to make truly informed decisions, they need a quality component as well, not just price. And that's pretty straightforward, it seems to me. Nobody would argue with that. We're not quite there on the quality yet, but there are some things where it's not about the difference between the skills of a cardiothoracic surgeon. It's an MRI. So if you know that you can drive 25 miles or 30 miles and get one for $300 less, why wouldn't you? And if you know that you can get a knee replacement for $1,000 or $2,000 less, depending on your deductible and copays and all that stuff, then why wouldn't you? If they've done 50 of them, these guys have done 100, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some things where it makes a difference right away. There is quite a bit of research coming out on this now. When we did the report, I think we only had access to one or two studies. Now there's about a half a dozen, and every single one of them is saying the same thing. It leads to savings. Now, the quality piece would be better. People are working on that. We'll get there. This is obviously or should be in the interests of employers to the extent they're still paying for some health care coverage for people. They don't want it to grow, the rates to grow as fast as they have. In fact, they paid for one of the big studies in about 20 different metropolitan areas. It should be of interest to insurers. You know, are the insurers representing us or are they simply billing agencies for the hospitals? You know, you have to ask that question. So everybody wins if we do it well, and I think we can and we should.
Well, Al Gobe, the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, raised this example of if you had, you know, out-of-pocket expenses that were X for a year and the procedure that you and I are talking about is way above and beyond that, that there's not really an incentive to get the cheaper one. And, in fact, there's kind of this weird disincentive that you somehow think the $30,000 knee job is going to be a lot better than the $25,000.
That can be addressed with quality information. Yeah. How many have they done? What are the outcomes? That information's available.
Okay.
We just haven't found a way to organize it and make it as accessible as the price information.
Okay. But are we paying, I mean, I know, you know, above and beyond certain amounts you pay, like if there's an 80-20 split. So is that where you see that my motivation would be to go for the cheaper thing?
You mean the copay?
Yeah.
As opposed to the, well, you combine the copay and the deductible. And by the way, that's one advantage of the way Massachusetts is doing. Because if you got on the website and said, this is what I want,
mm-hmm.
and if it's the insurance company, they know exactly where you are in your calendar year,
yeah.
how much you've kicked in for deductible. Have you already hit your number? In which case, you know, they got to cover everything else. Where are you with the copays? So that's no more work for them. They have that information.
Okay.
Every time you get a service, they kick back and say, well, this is how much you owe because.
Right.
So it's not new information that would have to be collected.
Okay. Because, you know, when I get my knee done, I want it to get done, and I don't care if it's a 25 or 30, but when you get your knee done, I want you to get the really cheap one. Isn't that, I mean, come on, isn't that a normal human nature?
Normal
no.
human nature.
All right. Sorry.
How do you define normal?
Okay. Well, maybe there's a test for that. So do you really think, what are you going to do? What are you going to try to do with this issue here?
We've done pretty much what we are required to do. We did the work. We presented the report both to House Health Care, House Ways and Means, Senate Finance. We may end up in Senate Health Care, but two of their key members are on Senate Finance. And they're now having conversations with other folks who are interested, NEA, SEA, AARP, VPIRC, all kinds of people think this is important. I don't know if there's that much more for us to do. Now it's up to those who have the statutory authority and the resources, which is the Green Mountain Care Board.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision for them is when and how and how much.
Did you, in the course of researching this, find, I mean, are there large disparities or are they small disparities?
CalPERS, which is the big pension fund in California,
yeah.
one of the biggest investors in the world, just did a study throughout California, which is the size of, you know, a continent. Nevertheless, they found differences in complicated knee replacements, for example, of $15,000, $20,000. From in different parts of the state. One of the earlier studies we were aware of, I think, was done all over the country with about 500,000 people involved. About half of them had information and the others didn't. The ones that did saved 19% on MRIs. That's not insignificant. You know, that doesn't sound like much if you've got a lot of money, save a few hundred bucks. But if you're a family with a high deductible and so forth, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, and so. If particularly if you've got to get a few of them, too.
Right.
So was there, but I'm sorry, maybe I didn't hear you. So was there a big wide disparity here in Vermont, too, and all this stuff?
There are considerable differences everywhere, not just in Vermont. Everywhere.
Okay.
And I'm sure there are reasons. For example, Fletcher Allen is both a teaching hospital and has huge overhead. They also but they are the institution, at least in Vermont, that has all the experts, that has all the equipment, that has everything. That's big overhead. They also have a lot of debt, but that pays for all sorts of things. And on the other hand, there may be, and there are, smaller regional hospitals which don't do the volume that Fletcher Allen does, for example. I know they have the new name, but I haven't gotten used to it
yet.
Sorry, you spent all that money on branding. Yeah. You know, what was that about? So, but the some of the other smaller hospitals don't do enough volume, perhaps, to justify the big expenditures they made on the equipment. So they may charge a little bit more, which helps them maintain their emergency room, which is essential to the region. But I don't think, I mean, that was, this was brought up during our testimony by someone who raised the issue, oh, this might force small hospitals to close their emergency rooms. I think there's got to be another way to tackle that issue than not provide consumers with information.
Good thing Fletcher Allen's on state leased land, too. Yeah. Let's go to Burlington. Reed, good morning.
Yeah. Hey, you know, suppose I go to my doctor, orthopedic surgeon, he said, well, you need an MRI. He just tells his secretary to call up, make an appointment for me somewhere. They don't say, well, would you rather go over to Morrisville because it's only $300 there? You really don't have any choice of where you're going for your surgery or for your tests. It's all cut and dried with the office.
Really? Okay. All right.
Well, I don't know. Actually, how would they respond if you said, well, are there any options? And why must I only go to the one you recommend? You know, you can have the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
It's your money. It's your body.
Let's go to Barry. Pete, good morning.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning to your guest. I have a couple of things. First of all, I want to congratulate the auditor. I think regarding issuing of costs at hospitals, so his answer is much better than the governor gave a few weeks ago. But also, I recently read an article regarding spring water and it being a natural resource. Why doesn't the state get involved in tapping that asset as it does other resources for some revenue? I'll get off the line and wait for your answer.
Okay.
It's a very good question, and I know that the legislature some years ago, within the last decade, had this very conversation because...
Like two, 3 years ago.
Was it that recently?
Yeah.
There are some companies in the state that bottle water.
Yeah.
And there was some question about whether it would be appropriate to tax them, and they haven't yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if the issue comes up, particularly in the context of the budget deficit.
Well, my recollection, though, is that they declare groundwater being a state resource, and that there were then limitations put on the amount that you could pull out on a either daily or a monthly basis, so that they were going to get at it that way.
Well, limiting the amount that can be withdrawn doesn't provide any revenue, though.
No,
if they're depleting a state resource, maybe the point was you can't deplete it faster than it can be re.
I think the idea was not to go after everybody's well, but to go after those big water companies was the idea.
That's a good question he raised.
244-1777 is our local number. Toll free 877-291-8255. Let's go back. You mentioned the liquor store issue, which you also looked into, and whether or not the state should be continue to be in this business of controlling, regulating liquor stores and also enforcing at the same time, too. So why'd you look into that?
Well, the legislature had expressed interest over time about couldn't we get some more money from this, not surprisingly, and other states are in the process, and a couple have recently privatized. So it's a big conversation around the country. Excuse me. And we thought it would be of interest to the administration and the legislature. As it turns out, I didn't know much about it going in. I find it very curious that we are comfortable, apparently, licensing the sale of beer and wine, but we actually own and sell spirits.
Right.
And I'm a little confused. I know the history, you know, post-prohibition, people were concerned, let's keep a handle on this and so forth. But this is 100 years later and thereabouts, and I'm curious why selling spirits is part of the core mission of the state of Vermont.
Mm-hmm. You know, okay.
That's for policymakers to decide, but just as a person, it occurs to me how curious.
Does the state somehow make more money controlling the business than if you and I had a store and they taxed us?
That's a good question. They tax us anyway, but they're heavily taxed. But what the state gets at present is the markup. Because technically, what happens is it's a weird system. The state owns a warehouse. It's filled with booze. And as soon as that booze is loaded onto a truck to be delivered to an agent's store, we own it. The people of the state of Vermont own those cases of Jack Daniels.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you just stop the truck and you say, hey, where's my fair
share? I'm a taxpayer,
share?
Right. And we set the markup. those agent stores have nothing to say about the price of that booze.
Okay.
That's done by a central entity, which is the Department of Liquor Control. And we also have excise taxes that are paid as well. And the state makes a fair bit of money on this. Whether we could make more or whether the prices would go up is the $64,000 question. We decided in the modeling that we had a contractor do to be very conservative and said, let's make it revenue neutral,
mm-hmm.
and making some assumptions. And that is that private folks would want a higher profit margin than the agent stores are paid.
All
we
right.
pay them up to 8.2% if they do well. The base
okay.
is 6.7. And I think it's clear that the private guys would want a higher profit margin. The question is, they would set their own prices, and
right.
some things might be more, some things might be less.
Furthermore, and then competition would come in, too. Yeah.
Competition would come in a big way.
Yeah.
What's happened is that big stores, not just Costco, which sells booze out west in Washington, one of the states just privatized, but I think it's likely that many, if not all, the larger giant supermarkets would get in the business. They already devote considerable resources and square footage to
mm-hmm.
beer and wine, and it would make sense for them to expand into
mm-hmm.
that. Would that hurt the local guys? Undoubtedly. But the question is not, we're not in the business of protecting those 78 agent stores. We're having a conversation at 35,000 feet about what's the best for the state. And I don't know the answer, but again, we provided some information and they can have the conversation.
Have you seen the size of the Jack Daniels bottles at Costco? Let's go to Corinth. Forbes, how are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
All right.
As I listen here, is the auditor only involved in the revenue side of things? Does he
No.
also audit and then make recommendations how we possibly could start to scale back on things?
Oh, not necessarily scale back. That wouldn't necessarily be a question going in, because the level of services provided is a decision for the legislature in every instance. But we've done some work on some very big entities in state, for example, the Department of Mental Health, Department of Aging and Independent Living, with regard to the so-called designated agencies, which used to be talked about as the community mental health centers. And they spend $260-70 million a year. And we were interested in looking at how closely these 11 entities are monitored and billing and payments and so forth. So, no, the answer to your question is we look at both sides. And we also looked at some AOT contracts for road paving and bridge work and so forth. So, you know, we're all over the map.
Okay. All right. Okay. Let's go to Montpelier. Good morning, Eudora. How's it going this morning?
Good. Mr. Hoffa, I took Seroquel, and then they want you to have me take a cheaper drug. So I was on quetiapine with Q on one side, 400 on the other. And I took that, and I worked excellent. Then they took that away and gave me a different drug that doesn't work, honey. But I'm still taking that. Thank you.
All right. Sounds like maybe they're trying to push her into generics or something here. Huh. Interesting.
And if that's all it is, that makes sense, of course, if it's literally the same formulation. But if they're, I don't know her story, of course. I don't know anything about her medications, but if you're taking something that's recommended that isn't working, then you should tell them, and hopefully they'll give you something that will work.
Like your recommendation with the last person here, you know, ask some questions of your doctor, God forbid.
Yeah.
What else are you working on here? We got a minute left. What else is going on?
We have an audit underway, in addition to the one about Vermont Health Connect, of the Department of Labor's workers' comp and UI shops, and the issue of misclassification by out in the field. If you work for me in a job and I tell you you're not my employee, you're an independent contractor,
ooh.
You don't have to pay unemployment
yeah.
insurance, workers' comp, so forth. Another one.
Wait, so how are you getting into this? Because this is a big issue.
It's a trade
boy.
Secret, Mark.
Yeah.
Only in a need to know. I can't talk
okay.
about it.
Okay. All right.
Another one is so-called transitional housing, which is a good-sized project from the Department of Corrections to assist people coming out of prison, reintegrating the community, providing beds and services. And we have some concerns about how those entities, those nonprofits, are monitoring and providing those services. We are just about to issue, within a couple of weeks, a long-standing report on the state's energy use and plan internally, just for the state itself.
Okay.
That's called the State Agency Energy Plan. That'll be out in a couple of weeks.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for coming in.
My
I appreciate
pleasure.
It very
Thank
much. You. See you out on the slopes. Just kidding. All right. Auditor of Accounts Doug Hoffer joining us here live in our studios this morning. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk a little bit about this idea of a carbon tax. Not a lot of interest in this among policymakers, but we'll talk with an expert on this who's going to be testifying before the legislature. That'll be coming your way at about 10:30. First, we'll check in with our White House crew. Keep your dial right here. This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, broadcasting from the top of Sugar Bush. FM 96.5 in Barrie and Montpelier. 101.9 in the Kingdom, and AM 550 WDEV, Waterbury, Montpelier. News is coming your way next.